the word bootstrapped mostly describes, okay, I got it to 3 million. It's making $1.5 million. I don't have a lot of employees. I don't have a lot of problems. This is great. The problem is, like, most of those companies are actually just slowly dying. But what creating companies like that can allow you to do is you get it to that, you get somebody else running it, and then you try to tinker around and like make another one. By the time you're like, oh, this is working, I'm actually going to focus on it, it ends up being bigger than the last one.
Welcome to the SaaS Revolution Show, a podcast by SaaSDoc. Here we interview SaaS founders from around the world who've been there and done that. They share the ins and outs of how they built their businesses, their operations, their path to securing investment, and more. Our mission with the podcast is to help you, the founder, learn how to scale your SaaS, maintain your well-being, and navigate the complexities of this ever-changing industry. I'm your host, Alex Diemer, and together we'll explore the good, the bad, and the ugly in the journey to SaaS success.
All right, welcome back to the SaaS Revolution Show. I'm your host, Alex Diemer, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Adam Robinson, who is the founder and CEO of Retention.com and RB2B. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Good to have you on the podcast for the first time, and we're also going to have you speak at SaaSDoc and SaaSDoc USA specifically for the first time. It's a little bit less than 2 weeks now, May the 13th to the 15th, so super excited to be back in Austin and have you at the conference, so very much looking forward to that. Obviously, we have you here now for our audio and video listeners as well, so we get to know a little bit about you and your story with Retention.com and RB2B. So super excited to jump into that. First off, you know, we always want to get to know our guests a little bit more, you know, beyond that they're the founder and CEO of a particular business. So we'd really love to know in depth a little bit, but, you know, who is Adam Robinson?
Yeah, well, you know, I live in Austin, Texas. I think at this point I'm 43 years old and my life's gotten pretty boring, man. I have a 2-year-old. My wife's pregnant again, so I'm in that mode of early family nesting. It took a long time. I was like a kind of single wanderer for a while. I had a really good stint as a digital nomad in my late 30s. I had another SaaS startup that was like kind of stuck at 3 million ARR, you know, bootstrap thing. And then before that, I was actually a credit default swap trader. I worked at Lehman Brothers for 10 years, actually. You know, I had this whole other life living in downtown Manhattan as like a Wall Street guy. And you can get a pretty good look at what that was like by watching The Big Short. That was literally the job that I had. And they did a really good job at like kind of constructing the reality that was around you if you did that. That was from when I was 22 to, you know, or 21 to like, you know, right at 30 or something. And I grew up in Houston, Texas, you know, no real drama there. It was kind of my boring childhood, you know.
I would imagine, seeing as you're doing it now, but you prefer the life as a SaaS founder to a Wall Street trader?
So, you know, the funny thing is I'm not even sure why, because there were not a ton of entrepreneurs around me in Houston. Most people just worked in oil and gas. But the couple that I saw, I just liked the freedom that I observed that they had in their schedule. Because, you know, I grew up in this neighborhood called Memorial. It was like, I would characterize it as upper middle class. Like, all of our dads were sweating it out to sort of, you know, send us to good colleges and like, you know, make sure we were, you know, playing on the sports teams and stuff. But, you know, I had a buddy whose dad, like, he had a company where the only two employees were his wife and his grandfather and his grandmother. And he had this office that looked over the high school baseball field, and his son played baseball. And that just to me seemed like, you know, my whole life, I didn't know where my dad went. You know, I just know that he left super early and came back super late. To be able to be that present, I equated that with entrepreneurship. And then, I showed up in New York in the first apartment that I lived in. I got connected with these guys through a guy I grew up with who went to a different university than me. And they were working on this website. Literally, like, as I'm like leaving for my first day of work, they're building this site. And it was Vimeo. the video sharing website. Can you imagine? Like, I watched that whole thing happen, and you know, my idea of what the compelling parts of entrepreneurship were sort of changed when I saw that. But and I didn't even have vocabulary for it, but it just seemed like they were getting more out of their work than I was. I happen to have caught this boom and subsequent bust cycle in the market in credit default swaps, which was amazing. I mean, I made a ton of money, which is kind of the goal for Wall Street. Like, you know, who makes millions of dollars in their 20s that doesn't start and sell a business? Like, that, as far as I know, that's probably the only other way to do it, you know? But yeah, I mean, it's like the crisis happened, I'd saved up and, you know, I made a bad career move. And then I was just like, the market was shrinking and I was kind of forced with either taking a demotion ish, like taking a worse job than I had, or just like trying to figure something else out. And at the time I was like, if I'm ever going to do it, now's the time. Don't have a family. You know, I can like take my fixed expenses to zero if I need to. And I'm just going to go with this pile of money that I have, like instead of going to grad school or whatever, I'm just going to spend it seeing if I can become an entrepreneur. So that was literally it. And that started just like from the day that I decided that to the day I paid myself a dollar. So I burnt through all of that. And I think regardless of how much money you have, you will burn through, a startup will consume all of it if that is what you set your focus on, especially for a first-time entrepreneur. I think for a second-time entrepreneur, you kind of could have the discipline to like realize if it was working or not. But 5 years went by from the time that I decided to be an entrepreneur to the time that I paid myself a dollar. It's been great since then, but like, you know, it was terrible in many ways.
Earlier on there, you said that you equated being an entrepreneur with being a bit more present, right? Now you are an entrepreneur, you know, a couple of times over. Do you think that still rings true?
So I don't get me wrong. Okay, that's a complex answer. I am in a very intense phase of my work life right now. I have one startup that has 55 employees that I am technically the CEO of, and I still go to the executive meetings and I still do one-on-ones with the executive team, but I'm not running it. I have another startup that I'm literally starting, which is RB2B, which has been so fun and amazing. And I realized that like this is for me the most fulfilling part of the journey. And then we have another startup inside of our company that my COO, Santosh, is putting together. It's an enterprise data sales business. So this is just a super intense period. I believe that, you know, my work life ever since I've been an entrepreneur has fluctuated in terms of intensity. I believe that will continue. That being said, I mean, I feel that there's tremendous upside to what I'm doing right now, yet, you know, aside from when I travel, which is not that much, I'm trying to like kind of only travel for really essential things. And to me, the definition now is like giving a keynote. Like I'll get on a plane and fly to New York for the day to like speak at an event. But like, aside from that, I'm trying not to travel. But my thing is like, wake my daughter up every day. I'm home at 6 every day. I'm only working during nap time on the weekends, and I take Wednesday mornings off until 11 a.m. to like take her to this music class. So to be playing at the level that I'm playing, I mean, look, I was in trading my whole career. Like I know how hard people work in banking. Like I saw all of my friends who were lawyers and private equity or whatever else. Like they don't have that part of their life doesn't exist. Like it's just, and it sounds, you know, probably one of the most heartbreaking things that just made me realize that I wanted to do something. So like, there were a lot of reasons that I quit. One of them was basically, I saw this over and over again. There was a guy who would stick around until like 7 p.m. at work doing nothing, just so that he didn't see his kids when he got home, because they would get so fired up if they saw him that they couldn't go to sleep. Can you imagine that? Well, like that, it's just, but that's the, you know, that's like, that, you tell that to somebody on Wall Street, they're like, oh, that makes sense. You know, whatever. Like, so yeah, I mean, it's a complex question to ask if I am free. In many ways, I am not at all, because there's so much work life that is absolutely 11 out of 10 pace. I'm able to constrain it to where I have this other thing. There's nothing else, though. I mean, I used to be a really social guy, and like, we're kind of not anymore, you know?
Similar to me, maybe with many entrepreneurs as well, but I guess of my job, I'm an entrepreneur, first-time entrepreneur, but also I run a events community business. There's a lot of talking to people. There's a lot of events, a lot of socializing. And by the weekend, I'm not a social person at all, because I've done all that socializing during the week, and therefore I just have no inclination to want to do that on the weekend. So I don't know if that correlates with just the energy that entrepreneurs obviously have to put into their business, that, you know, come the weekend, you know, there's barbecues or parties and you're like, I don't want to do that. You know, I just want to chill out, right? My energy's gone.
And again, you know, I've just like lived, even within, so like I've lived two totally different lives. That first Wall Street life, wildly social job. Like, one of the things that made you good at the job that I had was your ability to like maintain all of these relationships with people and get information and like all that stuff. But, you know, we were in our 20s, and your pseudo professional friends were kind of your social network. You know, you were hanging out with them on the weekends and all that stuff. My first company, I did not know my customers, which was interesting. It was like a SaaS product that was a newsletter app, and it was like Main Street USA, small, very small business, you know, $40 a month subscriptions, and I didn't know any of them. So like, it wasn't, the job wasn't social at all. Last year, I was trying to create a unicorn in the Shopify Plus space. The Shopify Plus space is very relationship driven. Like, you need a certain group of people to know you as a person before they're willing to try your product. So, man, I was getting crushed, just flying all around the world, every one of these events, like all this whatever, just for that, right? And then now this RB2B thing, it's like a freemium offer. So I'm back sort of in that. And by the way, like I'm creating this parasocial relationship through my LinkedIn profile, which is wonderful, because I don't have to go anywhere. I just sit here and write, and I make video content, and then it is taken care of me getting on planes and standing face to face in what I perceive as a much more efficient way. Actually, it's like you know, communicating this depth of thought and connection that I couldn't even have achieved had I gone to some event and talked to somebody for an hour, because it's just over time that they're absorbing this, you know? So my answer is kind of, if you have a job that's social, totally, you know, it's just, they can sort of fluctuate.
A couple of questions there. So I do want to touch on the LinkedIn piece, because obviously, you know, I think you've really exploded on LinkedIn in the last 12 months, but I want to come to that in a bit. Usually I ask, you know, what's the founding story of, you know, retention.com or, you know, one particular company. But here, as we know, and as you said, you've got a 55-person company, retention.com, which you've been running for about 3.5-4 years now. It's doing 25 million ARR, something more or less, pretty much.
21.7, man. It's just...
But it's still, yeah, it's pretty good. And I know, I saw your talk at SAS Open, and you were talking about how hard it is. I think a lot of European founders would certainly take you know the 21 million and maybe they would still say it is hard, right? So good achievement there. I guess my question is, why then start RB2B? Because you've got this 21 million ARR product, you know, why not focus and be the CEO of that company and get it to 100 million rather than do what is not a side project, is another company, right? But what were your thoughts around that?
I think the question at its core is just like, why are you doing this? That's what I think it amounts to. I would have answered this question in different ways at different parts of my journey. Man, now this might sound crazy to some people, but like, I really just love the game. You know, like doing, you have to do something in life. I certainly do. Like, I have too much energy to sit there on the beach and, like, you know, sort of read books and write poetry or whatever it is, right? My thing that I would do right now, if you wired me $1 billion, is try to get RB2B to be a huge company, because I don't know if I can do that yet, you know? And, like, it's such a challenge inside of me to, like, it's like, okay, I'm looking at retention.com at 21.7 million. I know that I can do that. I don't know if I can build a 100 million ARR company, but I know people have. And I know a couple people have even done it bootstrapped. If I can do that, that's like a wow. You know what I mean? Like there's so, and it's like, so like one thing that I don't think it's talked about much is in the community is like, okay, it's like bootstrap versus VC. And I think the word bootstrap kind of mostly describes what my first company was, which was like, okay, I got it to 3 million. It's making $1.5 million. I'm doing the 37 signals thing. I don't have a lot of employees. I don't have a lot of problems. This is great. The problem is, like, most of those companies are actually just slowly dying. I was able to sell mine for $10 million, which is great. But I think what creating companies like that can allow you to do is kind of what I've done, which is like, you get it to that, you get somebody else running it, and then you try to tinker around and, like, make another one. And usually with the skills that you acquired on that first one, whatever the next thing is that hits, you're doing it a lot better and more efficiently. So, like, and you have kind of like a better understanding of product market fit and marketing and, you know, all the and product in general and all that important stuff. And it usually, by the time you're like, oh, this is working, I'm actually going to focus on it, it ends up being bigger than the last one, right? And then, this is my point in all this. There is a point that you reach as a bootstrapper. I don't know where it is. Maybe it's like 10, 15, maybe 20 million ARR, if you've run it properly, where it's so profitable that if you're still interested in continuing this game of stacking these things on top of each other, like, for me, it's about to get absolutely incredible. I mean, I showed our financials at that SaaS talk thing. It's like, we're paying ourselves fat salaries and our business is going to make another $6 to $8 million, which we're just going to pay ourselves. If I can get RB2B and data sales to work, like, it just is weird even saying it. Like, we could have like a $20 million free cash flow business that, like, we're running with basically our friends. Like, I just can't even imagine anything more wonderful than that. You know? So it's like, why do I do it? It's like, I feel like I'm so close to this point of massive upside in so many ways, you know? And it's like, maybe you call it your eyes on the prize, or like there's this, you know, light and it's like so close. But like, you know, if you can get past a certain point as a bootstrapper, like, it just, I mean, it just gives you the power to do so many different things. I mean, I'm taking on Sixth Sense right now. I don't know if you saw it. Like, there's no way that I could just go to a $5.2 billion company, walk up and punch him in the face. It's like, sue me. I don't give a fuck. like I could probably afford lawyers better than you. Like, you're going to burn $100 million this year, right? Like, you a venture debt, by the way. Like, there, it's a strange situation where you're actually a much stronger entity than much larger companies. And it just gives you the freedom and flexibility to do a lot of stuff. So that was a really long-winded answer of like advocacy of bootstrapping and sort of taking, you know, I think it's really easy to say, like, okay, you could bootstrap or take VC. If you bootstrap, then it's going to just take you a lot longer, but you'll get to the same spot. I don't necessarily think that that's true, but I think that it just gives you the ability to kind of stack businesses on top of each other. And then one works, you sell the last one, like, whatever.
I think segues into the discussion point that we kind of landed on, that yes, you are bootstrapped, and yes, you've got, you've created this freedom for yourself by bootstrapping, retention.com and, you know, getting this free cash flow. But last year, I think it was, that you thought that you could, you know, grow at the pace of a VC-backed company. It was something that you tried, perhaps didn't work out the way that you were expected, and a few lessons learned there. So do you want to tell us the story of that and you know, take us through it, and what were the lessons learned?
Yeah, that's a polite way to say it. So yeah, the impolite way somebody would say it is this guy who is an egomaniac made a show about himself, about how he was going to basically build a unicorn in a year, and like missed by, you know, the revenue target over 50%, and then the unicorn, I don't know, maybe by over 80% or 90. I was heavily under the influence of the Jasper AI story. I had been hanging out, which is a great story, by the way. I've been hanging out with these guys, you know, sharing an office with them before they were Jasper. They were called Proof. They were stuck at 2.5 million ARR. I was stuck at 3 million ARR. At the time, Dave and I had decided that we wanted to create, I had started Get Emails, which is now retention.com. It was also at 3 million ARR. So I had 2 3 million ARR startups that each had 6 employees that each were churning out $1.50 of cash. So I was like, Dave, like reduce your staff, start a few. We should each have 4 or 5 of these things, right? Like then, you know, million ARR, like it's, you know, what, million MRR, it's like cranking out $6 million worth. That's a good life, right? So he's like, yeah, cool. And by the way, they were running out of cash. They were like, this was the last attempt at something that they had. So I get this text on like December 22nd. He's like, sends me a Stripe receipt. It's $100. He's like, first paying customer, got the idea 7 days ago. Hopefully this is my Get Emails. So that's what the text said. Like, cause mine was like the high watermark at the time. And this was going to be his second startup. And then over the next 12 months, they went from 0 to 50 million ARR faster than any other startup ever, which I just watched. And I experienced this major transformation that I have never felt listening to any other stories about anybody else. Like I would make it analogous. Like, you know, I listened to like How It Was Built or something with the Twitch TV guy. And I hear that story and it doesn't feel, I don't connect to it because these guys are living in San Fran, you know, sitting in a room with people who did not go to Stanford and are from Maryland and were schmucks just like I was 12 months prior, I can't even explain to you how real and how possible doing something much bigger becomes, right? Like you are the average of the 5 people that you spend the most time with and your ambition really is. So anyway, I had Get Emails kept growing, right? And like by the end of that, it was at like 8 million ARR with 6 people. And, you know, I was looking at it and I was looking at their business and I was like, okay, they got to 50 million ARR, but like they're spending $2 million a month on Facebook ads. Like what if I was spending $2 million a month on sales and marketing? My business is probably bigger than that, right? So it took me a while to find someone who is Santosh, my COO, who's built a lot of companies and could guide us through this transitional phase. But like, I decided I'm going to go for it. And we had a ton of free cash to do this, so I didn't have to go out and raise. But really, what I believed at the time was we sort of decided that as we came to the conclusion that large Shopify Plus stores were our perfect buyer and that they never churned. The thing that I assumed was that in only giving demos to those people, our churn problem would be solved. And what else I did, which was sort of, it was just wrong, is like I kind of chopped the price of what we were selling in half and then added this other, doubled the value of it. And I believed that in a year, we could double the prices on everybody and we get this unbelievable revenue expansion thing going on. And then all of that together with the sales velocity we had, because it really did have pretty good product market fit in that space. I was like, this is a unicorn twice over. I mean, it's going to be no problem. So it just became, and that's why I started posting on LinkedIn. It just became a like, how do I create the most awareness possible? I found this girl who I'm like, man, I should make a TV show about this. Everybody says that about startups. No one has the resources to. So got this girl to make the show. It was really cool. If you go to my YouTube page, Retention Adam, there's 2 seasons of it, 18 episodes or 10 minutes each. We're going to make another season actually at the end of this year. And then look, like fast forward, you know, a year and a half, what was I wrong about? Well, I assumed that this was just going to be like a Klaviyo metrics type situation. Klaviyo's the email marketing app for Shopify. And what I got wrong there was Klaviyo is an incredibly low churn product category, meaning if you're storing data for someone, if you're a CRM, if you're a system of record, that is the lowest churn product there is. Why? Because there's only one thing you do if you go to Klaviyo. You go to, or if you quit Klaviyo, you go somewhere else, right? You got to put your data somewhere else because that's driving business. If you turn retention.com, there's 8 reasons or 9 reasons why you turn retention.com off, which is basically selling leads, right? Or selling intent data. Like, if you turn it off, the only difference between before and after is it's not there anymore. And like the revenue that we were producing for you isn't there, but like there's, things are still, you know, your life still continues, right? So anyway, that was the biggest fundamental issue. And then this other terrible thing happened where we were crushing it so hard and I was being so loud about it, like all of a sudden we got 5 competitors and then renewals come around and the competitors are just like using BuiltWith, hitting everybody up who are in deals with us. And they're like, well, we'll do more for less. So instead of a revenue expansion environment, which we had modeled out, we're actually contracting at renewal, you know? So basically the story is for all of those reasons, the churn dynamic is just so much worse than I could have ever imagined, having believed that I had solved the churn problem, that this really has the characteristic in its current state of an EBITDA business, which is fine, right? Like it's going to make a lot of money this year. It's just not what I thought it was. And by the way, in doing so, probably the biggest mistake that I made was like losing all fiscal discipline or financial, whatever the word is, as a bootstrapper. There's a certain way you operate as a bootstrapper. And like I had also parted ways with that philosophically. And I was just spending like a sailor, setting a poor example. Everybody who worked for us spending like a sailor, hiring super expensive employees, didn't even care what we're paying them. Like nothing worked. And now, you know, yeah. So that was the lesson. And now kind of like back to normal.
Did you have Santosh or, you know, members of your team coming to you and saying, Adam, like, what are you doing or what are we doing and we need to stop this? Or did you kind of come to the realization yourself, like obviously looking at the numbers, that this just wasn't working?
Yeah, I think I felt it sooner than most people. We have Kelly, who's our chief of staff, but also really our CFO, is just much more conservative than me. So she was kind of like breaking my balls on it the whole time, you know, but like, yeah, I knew it had to stop. Really it was like, there was a period from the end of September of 22 to like mid-April or May of 23 that it was absolute euphoria. And then it all started, the whole tower fell, you know, and it was like a cleanup effort. And you know, we're still to some extent dealing with it. I mean, we hired 50 people in like 60 days. Like I'm just learning now, we have an executive coach that's rolling out entrepreneur operating system with us right now. And like before this exercise that we've been going through for now, you know, 6 weeks, Santosh would have said, my biggest weakness as an entrepreneur is I don't know what it means to instill processes in an organization. And I couldn't even have told you what that meant, right? I'm like, what do you mean? We have a process for expenses and we have a process for answering customer support tickets or whatever. But it's true. Like I didn't, right? And like now we're doing a type of, we're setting up a type of processes that allows you to manage, you know, 50 people and keep everybody focused on things that are going to move the needle for the organization, which is just so difficult. And like, we had nothing like that when we hired all these people. And like, of course it didn't work, right? We didn't have our way of doing things. And then we invited a bunch of high powered people from a bunch of other places that had their way of doing things. And it was just a total, total mess.
Now that we're in May, I can officially say that the countdown for SaaS.USA 2024 is on. In less than 2 weeks, I'll be joined by the brightest minds in North American SaaS, 1,500 folks, SaaS founders, investors, and operators, for 3 days of connecting, and meaningful conversations that could really potentially transform you and your business. We've got incredible sessions in the agenda, from funding, growth, product market fit, to seasoned advice for those that are facing the lonely reality of being a founder. If you're stuck at a certain ARR, you know that those that are there have been there through that and will help you get through it. You name it, the SaaStock stage has got it. But beyond the content, really, you've got to come there to meet your peers, meet your potential investors, meet growth advisors, meet the people that can unstick you, help you through your plateaus. You're going to get meaningful conversations, real transformation. It's going to make a difference. So use code SASREV, S-A-A-S-R-E-V, for 20% off your SaaStock USA pass. Are you a software company struggling to navigate the complex world of payments? We get it. Getting paid should be simple, but as you grow, it gets complicated. Different currencies, payment methods, regulations, and taxes, it's enough to make anyone's head spin. But Paddle's got your back. We handle tax, payments, billing, subscriptions, fraud, and so much more all across the globe. Paddle does the heavy lifting so you can focus on what really matters, your products and your growth. Get started at paddle.com.
So like you mentioned, I think over a year ago, you started posting on LinkedIn pretty frequently. I mean, maybe you can comment on the frequency, but it seems that you built this great awareness, getting a lot of, engagement on your post. They're very, very honest. As I think I heard somebody say at a recent SaaStock founder membership retreat, even some of the posts are a little bit too honest. Like, I can't remember the specific ones, but where you kind of like fucked up on certain stuff and you're like, oh, you know, is he oversharing there? But tell us a little bit about like why, from when you started, have you followed a strategy? Is it just you just like dumping thoughts on there? You mentioned obviously you're kind of writing every day. You know, is there a strategy? What's the benefit, to you, to the business, and maybe some learnings from that and your year-long sort of LinkedIn experience?
I actually give a keynote on this because the marketing world is like, it's like the founder world. I think they're more interested in like my journey, you know, and the marketing world is much more interested in like, how do I make my CEO a channel? Which this is. There's no other way to describe it than like it's like SEO or like paid whatever. So if you want to see that deck, which very clearly describes the journey, email me at adam@retention.com. I'll send it to you. So long story short, it took me 12 months to really have it click and have a clear strategy that I understood and that I understood why it was doing what it was supposed to do. That's not to say that it wasn't effective before that. It's just like the difference between like a good and a great business. Like now this is a great channel, and before it was like okay and really expensive and I was putting a ton of effort into it and I wasn't really clear about what it was doing, but it was doing a lot. You know, now I would say it is the most powerful thing you could ever have if you were in the position that I am in, which is now pushing out a product that did not exist 2 months ago into a market that are rabid consumers of my content and my ideas that also live on LinkedIn, right? So like if all of those things are aligned, there is nothing that could be more powerful than having the presence that I have on LinkedIn. If that last piece isn't there, if you're selling to people who don't spend their lives on LinkedIn, then being a LinkedIn guy like me is not maybe going to help you with investors, maybe going to help you hire, maybe going to help, you know, partnerships or whatever, but it's not going to be something that is worth. I mean, I put a huge amount of time and attention into this. So what I would say is the strategy, I post 3 times a week. I'm trying to bring it to 4. And I would say that what that person said, I get where they're coming from. A lot of people ask me, they walk up, they're like, how do you write what you write? Like there were a couple things, right? Like I put last month was super hard. It's like a fourth down month in a row and it was down 2.3%, which is just nasty. I mean, that's just like horrible as a SaaS vendor. And I'm sitting there talking about, you know, we have competitors. It's a new operating environment. We got to figure this out. By the way, like this time of year is always bad for us, but like some really good things are happening that are like 9 months away. But like right now it's terrible and I don't know when it's going to turn. Right. So, one of my, when I started this, the one thing that I was confident about was, so it's like, if you start publishing content, it's like, why would anyone spend their time consuming it? I think you need to ask yourself that, right? Like, how am I different than like the slew of nonsense that's out there? And by the way, I've just gone through the experience of watching Jasper AI rise. And I'm like, okay, the B minus crap is going to get amplified by like 100x. What can Jasper not write? It's like, Jasper can't write my financials, right? Like everybody wants to know how much money you're making, right? Like, so that was like and I'd watch some people do some build in publics, like Nathan Berry of ConvertKit and, you know, a couple other people. And that's just content that's like super, I know, because 5 years ago, I was anything that Nathan Berry, and I was in a competitive space, but like any word that he wrote, I would consume like a rabid dog, right? Like I just needed like to read about what people were doing who were ahead of me, and it was nowhere. You know, I couldn't find it. So like I knew that just for me that would be great content, so I had a sense that people would read it. So that was like kind of, you know, a pillar that I found on my own. And then a year in, we hadn't even decided to make this B2B product yet, but like this LinkedIn guy that I work with, Alec Paul, was like, if you start writing to B2B people, we will absolutely slay with the amount that you're willing to put into this. So I'm like, okay, well, let's figure that out. And then we made some posts, and this is all in the deck. It was like 4 posts in a row, like, you know, 2.5 million impressions, just like blew the doors off. And then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I know what LinkedIn wants, right? Like, so I think what I have recently discovered is that what this is doing more powerfully than anything else. And by the way, that what can Jasper not do? Like it also video, right? Like it's not quite there to where it can create an Adam Robinson talking head, Chris Walker style, that people know is not bullshit, right? So that's why I put all this video out. I think that it's just much more engaging medium. And like what I've realized is like the most powerful part of this is people feel like they know me now. And I think that's the most secret weapon. It's like, let's talk about Sixth Sense versus me, right? Like, well, they have a great leader, this marketing person who goes around and talks or whatever. But like, it's largely this brand that you just sort of idolize. You know, it's like that's startup success. Whereas like, there's a much deeper human connection to me sharing how hard it is to build a startup. I mean, I think that's what everybody wants to hear. It's a weird thing with your employees. And I do get pushback with our chief of staff. She's like, dude. And I'm like, I hate to say this, but like, this is doing more for us than literally anything else. And our employees are not the audience. And by the way, like when they started working here, they knew I was going to do this. And quite frankly, I think they would rather know that shit sucks than like us lying to them about it. Right. So like, so anyway, I cannot even explain the power of everyone in this world increasingly feeling like they know you as a best friend. And like I walk into an event now and I can just stand there and people will come up in groups of two and be like, I love your content. You know, how did you write this? Like this, whatever. And I can tell that they're looking at me like they feel like I'm an old buddy, you know? Whose product are they going to use? Mine, right? If I have anything that is a substitute for anything that they are doing and they feel that way, they're going to buy from me, right? Like that's kind of like the, yeah. I mean, that's it, right? Like I wouldn't be doing this if it were not, I just think it's the most, in today's world, it is the most capital efficient. If you can nail it like this, and it's that paradigm that I described, right? Whatever platform you're doing it on, your buyers are living there. There could not possibly be a more capital efficient way to spread awareness in your buyers, you know? And like, it's not even awareness. It's like one more example, and I'm rambling here, but like, this has just started happening in the last 3 or 4 months. Like people walk up and be like, are you Adam Robinson, right? So South by Southwest was in Austin in March. I went to 3 events in one night on Thursday. First event, somebody done Live in Austin walks up. It's like, I love your stuff. Great. Second, I read your stuff every week. It's awesome. At the third one, a guy walks up to me, puts his hand on my shoulder and like looks deep in my eyes. And I'm like, I think I know where this is going. But like, what's up, dude? He's like, hey, man, I'm a 1 million ARR SaaS founder in New York. Like, your stuff, literally, I send every post to every member of our team. Like, I so respect that you're not a VC guy. You're grinding it out. You're actually sharing what it's like and not just the good stuff like everyone else. You're the most inspirational person in my life right now. So like, can you imagine if the primary marketing vehicle of your company is also creating that type of fandom, right? Like that type of affinity. Compare that to paid ads or like whatever, you know, email market, like cold emailing, right? Like what else could you do to create that? Like, I don't think there's anything, right? So it's like, that's the reason I'm on this podcast. Like my whole strategy is like, I am going to invest zero in traditional marketing. I mean, I got a guy doing cold email, but like, whatever, it's not really contributing in a meaningful way. And like, I'm going to do brand. This is my opinion of what brand is now. And I'm just going to spend all of my time and energy and money on this version of brand. Unmeasurable, right? Like no VC would let you do it and then not charge for your product. That's another thing. It's like, I have a free product and I just look at it as, I watched MailChimp. The power of free is so beyond what I think anyone understands. And like, this is my version of burning in a startup. It's like, you could charge for it and then go back and pay for distribution, or you could just make it free. And literally everybody's going to try it. And then you get this unbelievable amount of information about how people are using it, how you might be able to monetize someday or whatever. So after this experience, I plan to start every product with free just because it's so wild what's happened, you know?
Just on the free thing, I just interviewed yesterday the CEO of Jotform. He's been bootstrapping for like 18 years, but whilst he didn't say that, I think they're north of 100 million.
This is my dream. I mean, there's amazing story there.
And on the LinkedIn stuff, I mean, almost certainly that's how we discovered you, invited you to speak at the conference, come on the podcast. So, another measure of the impact there, which I'm sure you've seen before. And a very quick story, because I'm conscious of time. At SAS Open, I think after your talk, I was standing in the hallway. Somebody came over, I don't know if they put their arm around me, but they were like, oh, I loved your talk. And they thought I was you, but we look nothing alike apart from the fact that we're both tall and you're even taller. I was like, no, I'm not Adam Robinson, but thank you. Anyway, but we'll, on that, let's move quickly into the quickish fire round. So Adam, can you tell us, maybe I know this, what one thing has moved the needle the most for you in your career?
Man, this is a weird thing to say, but I think the Sixth Sense thing that just happened last week might be the most single impactful event of my entire career.
Okay, we'll follow that one. What's the best advice you've ever received?
Reputation takes a lifetime to build and a second to destroy.
Perhaps we've covered this one. A biggest failure you've made and lesson learned? Was it the last year's experience?
I think the hardest ones are when you have to lay off a lot of people at one time. And I've had to do that twice, and my glass door will explains those. I think those are the hardest. So without a doubt that, and you know, it's part of last year's journey.
Have you a favorite book on business and why, or something that you've read that's kind of helped you, on your business journey?
Yeah. So when we're talking about building startups, I think the best one hands down is 4 Steps to the Epiphany. And if people could just have the discipline to try to follow that as close to page by page as they can. And there's emotional reasons why you don't want to, but like, if you can do that, your odds of success are so much higher than if you just follow your gut. So yeah, that's the one.
Okay. And as we wrap up, Adam, I mean, obviously a fantastic, fascinating conversation, and has given me a flavor of what's more to come at SaaStock USA, which obviously brings us to that you're speaking at SaaStock USA. So I guess two things there. What are you speaking about? Why should people, you know, come to your talk, you know, meet you in person rather than, let's say, on LinkedIn? And maybe what's your favorite thing about Austin as well that people should do whilst they're in town?
Yeah, so that talk that I give, I mean, it is literally the journey, right? And the interesting thing of retention.com and into RB2B, and the interesting thing about it is, if you look, you know, the first slide's literally like the quarterly revenue. There's two spots when I genuinely felt like it was stuck. Once at below 3 million ARR, and then again at around 6. And by the way, like now we're in a down part. And so the whole theme is like, are you stuck? You know? And like the whole world, my experience as an entrepreneur is, it's just getting stuck and getting unstuck again. Like that is my, if I summarize my whole journey over the last 11 years, that is the theme. So it's a 20-minute talk. I can't do a 20-minute talk on LinkedIn. I have never written about this whole journey. And I just think if I were a found, and by the way, like before GetEmails, like Robly was stuck at 3 million for 4 years, you know? So I think a lot of SaaS founders are stuck. I know I was. When I was stuck, I was going to events like SaaStock, literally grabbing for any information about what people were doing that worked, right? When what I know now is, the reality is, I just have a better product than I had then, right? All of this stuff that people are telling you is working, they just have a better product than you. So everything works. When your product is not good, nothing works, right? So like the art of getting unstuck is the art of making everything that you're doing better so that it clicks, right? Into this product market fit thing. I just teach you all of the lessons that I learned along this very emotionally tumultuous journey that is my first company and then, you know, what I'm trying to do now. That's why I would go. That's why I would go if it were me 5 years ago. I would be all, that's why I try to, that's who I'm writing for. It's like, I'm envisioning myself stuck at 3 million ARR 3 years in. What does this person want to know that is inside of my head, right? And that's what that presentation is. And I really liked how it all, I sat there for a day and made the deck. I like really like how it all sort of flows, so.
Very much looking forward to seeing that. And top thing to do in Austin for people that are coming in?
Yeah, so Austin has this very, very cool public pool, which sounds dirty, but it's not. It's a natural spring-fed, massive pool carved into these rocks called Barton Springs. I would highly recommend going there. The water is like 71 degrees, which is very cold. And the air can be very hot. So it's this like almost cold plunge-like effect to jump in. And it's got like kind of this amphitheater grass seating. And it's just a vibe. It's just super cool. So I would go to Barton Springs.
Awesome. Something I haven't done yet, so I'll try and get that done, even though we're running the event. But maybe as soon as it finishes, we'll jump in.
Yeah, jump in as a team. It's great.
Yeah, exactly.
Get a picture.
Yeah. This has been awesome. Really insightful conversation. Really thank you for your time. Looking forward to seeing you at SaaStock USA May 13th to the 15th in Austin at the Palmer. Where can people find you online? Would LinkedIn be the best place, or where can people reach out?
I think LinkedIn's the best place now. Or just email me at adam@retention.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Adam Robinson, CEO of retention.com and RB2B. And see you in a couple of weeks at SaaStock USA.
Thank you, Alexander. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the SaaS Revolution Show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you learned something from it, check out saasdoc.com/events to find all the upcoming SaaStock conferences around the world. Want exclusive SaaS content and actionable insights to grow your SaaS? Join our community of over 36,000 SaaS founders at saasdoc.com.